The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
Where did you get the idea for this novel?
This, strangely enough, is based loosely on fact. I had a good friend who recently retired as an ATF senior special agent, and he had been a young deputy sheriff in Cascade County as a young man, and there was actually such a character as John Glode afield in those days, and he did babysit him in jail as he was awaiting trial.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Kim Zupan is my guest, and we're talking about his novel, The Plowmen. The Plowmen is set in various locations scattered across northern Montana, which is a landscape that you know well because you grew up in that area. So for the benefit of listeners who've never been out in that country, tell us what it's like.
Well, it's very raw and diverse country. We've got the Brakes, which are the very rugged coulee country around the Missouri River. But we've also got some lovely island mountain ranges like the Highwoods and the Little Belts, the Moccasins, the Judiths, that kind of thrust up from the prairie. So it's really interesting, diverse country. It's very beautiful, and at the same time, it's very brutal and can, you know, kill you with a blink of an eye. So,
if John Glode doesn't get you first.
If John Glode doesn't get you first, exactly.
Well, in this novel, a relationship develops between two men, a young deputy sheriff, Valentine Millimackey, and an old criminal, John Glode. Before we talk about Glode, let's know a little bit about Val. In the first paragraph of the prologue, if you would read that, we find out who he was when he was a boy.
Sure. The boy got off the bus at the end of the dry lane in the fall of the year, the shelter belt as he shuffled past, shirring with the sound of grasshoppers that wheeled crazily out of the weeds and dusty pale leaves of the Russian olives, blundering into his pants legs, careening off his shirt front. One day a month, he and his schoolmates were released early and encouraged to use the time to perform corporal works of mercy. Val was a serious boy. He shifted his books from hand to hand as he walked toward the far house and began to list them: visit the sick, clothe the naked, bury the dead. What others? The neighbors' black cattle from the bluff looked down, their shapes swimming and wandering eerily in the heat haze. Visit those in prison, that was one. Give drink to those who thirst. To the west, he could see his father on the Minneapolis Moline, circling the Schmidt Field in a cirrus of dust below the bluff.
I thought that was just a brilliant opening because it shows us, without really showing us, because you don't know for a while into the story, this relationship that's going to develop between this young man and this older man. When you were in the process of writing, do you remember, did this paragraph come first or did that part of the story develop first?
That's an interesting question because, the corporal works of mercy kind of appeared later. I did have the scene and the notion of Val walking down the lane toward his house to provoke kind of a feeling of melancholy right from the beginning. But then I realized this was absolutely consistent with his character to think about these corporal works of mercy. And he was a serious boy, as is noted, and he was also a compassionate boy. And it seemed that it kind of set up or gave a map for his future.
If we judge John Glode just from his deeds, he's really a horrible man, a methodic killer, which we find out right away in chapter one as we watch him in a scene do his work. But I think I felt the most horror reading the scenes that you wrote about his conversations with Val And I'd like you to read a short passage from one of those scenes. It takes place, as most of them do, in the county jail at night. And Glode has just told Millimacki about his own father's death.
From some distant duct grate or from the imperfect street-level windows, a breath of air set Glode's bare light bulb swaying, the pull chain tinkling softly, and he turned his gaze upward. At the corners of his eyes were long, deep crevices disappearing into his sparse hairline. And from his chronic sleeplessness, as if drawn with a pen, his inflamed eyes were rimmed with red. From the endeavor of the long narration and the reliving of the winter night that would recreate him in the world, he seemed depleted. His voice, when he at last spoke again, was faint and hoarse. He said, "I went from there to a hospital, to an orphanage, run by these strange ladies dressed up in black, all in a matter of a few weeks. I gotta say, it was a tough old time for a kid." "I imagine it was," Millimacki said. "My old man went down for a nap and just kept sleeping, and that was bad enough." Glode stared out through the bars. He sat erect in his chair and raked back the thin strands from his forehead and cleared his throat. "When did this happen?" "Oh, that's been a year now, year and a half." "You lost your old man?" 62 years old, died in his chair. "That's tough." "He was a decent man. Had this kind of crazy temper, but he only hit me once and I had it coming." "Died in his chair," Glode said, "and you felt like you should have been there." "Oh, I don't know, not so much. My cousin was there to check on him every day." "Felt like you could have done something to prevent it, I imagine." Val stared in at the old man. "It just happened. His life was hard." 62 years of age. Lost your old man at a young age, same as me." He paused conspicuously to allow the gravity of kindredship to fill the moment. "Not all that young," Millimacki said. Glode went on as if he hadn't heard. "And your mother?" he said. "Where is she?" "Gone a long time now." "And I bet she ran off on you all, didn't she? Same as mine. I bet she skipped out." Millimacki stood up. "Like I said, it was a long time ago." Glode's hands appeared. He grasped the bars of his cage and leaned his face into the fluorescent light. "We're just a couple of hard luck orphans, ain't we, Valentine?"
I mean, the creepy factor was just amped up when you think about these conversations taking place while everyone around them is sleeping, and neither one of them can sleep because the deputy's working the graveyard shift and the old guy just doesn't sleep. Why do they have insomnia?
Well, in Glode's case, I think, and he attributes it to at various times to his age, I think it's fairly well known that as we get older, we have more difficulty sleeping. In his case, it had nothing to do with feeling guilt or anything like that. He was utterly incapable of that. In Millimacki's case, a number of factors contributed to it. Largely, his marriage was kind of falling apart at this time. And needless to say, that had an effect of keeping him from sleep, as well as his work outside of the jail was in searching for lost people. And he'd been on a bad run of luck. His last several victims he had found were dead rather than struggling out of the brush and, you know, miraculously alive. So those two things contributed to his sleeplessness, I think. Not only that, being stuck in this horrible dungeon-like atmosphere late at night with a killer probably didn't have really a soporific effect by any means.
Mm-hmm. And we should explain that Val has a dog, a German Shepherd, who's trained to find them.
Right.
And so he could just get off a graveyard shift and get called out to go find somebody, and it would take all day, and then he wouldn't get any sleep before he went back to work.
Exactly. That happens a few times during the course of the story. And as you might imagine, I think one would find it difficult to sleep after having hauled a frozen corpse out of the woods. It probably would keep one awake, particularly if there's been a run of such instances. So, yeah, he definitely earned his insomnia.
And felt bad because he hadn't been able to find them before they died.
Yeah. Right. He's a good Catholic kid, so he's got a good, you know, good dose of guilt on top of everything else, feeling as though had he gotten there earlier or somehow taken a different turn, he might have been able to extricate these people from, you know, from the deep woods. So he's got that going on, too.
Several reviewers compared John Glode to Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. I was not brave enough to watch that movie or read that book, so I can't say whether I thought there was a comparison. What did you think?
Oh, I was horrified when I heard that and continue to be. There couldn't be more different as far as I'm concerned. Glode, for all his faults, is not as nearly as devious as the Hannibal Lecter character. He's an extremely simple man. His tastes are simple. His life is simple. As far as he is concerned, his job, however gruesome, is just that. It's a job. So, you know, those comparisons, I guess they're inevitable, but I find them distasteful.
I guess they have to say something.
They have to say something, right. One thing that I feel compelled to say, you'd think after all this time when someone asked me, what's the book about, which you haven't done, thankfully, and I appreciate that. I'm still not very good at it because it's not a particularly plot-driven novel. It's more character-driven. But I remember when I first submitted it and my agent read it and he wrote back to me and said, well, this is a love story. And I realized that I'd accomplished what I'd wanted to, because I really do feel it is a love story, however bizarre and twisted it may be, but it is a love story between these two men, as well as the, you know, the story of their respective marriages. But I think of it as a love story, and it's strangely kind of comes to fruition at the end of the book without giving anything away, I think. But it's not a Hannibal Lecter story. And it's not a crime novel, and it's not a number of things. I think the industry tends to want to pigeonhole books, and I've seen this described as a crime novel, a thriller, and so on. And, you know, not to denigrate either of those genres, they're wonderful, but, you know, it's a crime novel in the same way that Moby Dick is a fishing story. You know? So it has the attributes of a crime novel, maybe. I mean, there's a sheriff, and there's a criminal, and, you know, there's a dog in there. There may be horses in there somewhere, but that's as far as the comparison should go, really.
There was a point in the story in which Millamaki thinks, in this country, it's just hard to be alone. Why did he think that?
Well, at that particular moment, I think when that quote came up, you know, his marriage had fallen apart. He was looking for a young girl who was lost at that moment. And a fellow deputy had just told him he had to run to town because he had a domestic dispute, and it was a couple who had fought frequently. And I think the one deputy says something like, you know, he's beaten her up and pulled hunks of hair out of her head, and the next day I see them sitting in a restaurant like teenagers. And he couldn't figure out why that was, and Millamaki said later on to himself, it's just hard to be alone. And I think that part of the world, or our part of the world, you know, the landscape is so raw, and the wind is, you know, whistling down from these frozen crags, and it's a huge open country. And I think it can be hard to be alone if you're not suited for it. You know, if you're not a writer, for example, who by necessity or choice spends large blocks of time alone, I think, you know, particularly when you're thrust into this huge, open, bleak landscape, that can be difficult for people. I mean, there are famous stories of homesteader women, particularly, who went mad in the great, vast openness of the prairie. And I think it's a difficult place to live, or it can be.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Kim Zupan about his novel, The Plowmen. If you tuned in late, you can hear what you missed on the Right Question blog, which you can get to at mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find a link on our Facebook page. We'll be right back to talk about Kim Zupan's unusual writing schedule and hear another passage from the novel. Don't go away. There are a lot of birds in this novel.
I can't explain that. I wish I could. They just seem to insinuate themselves somehow. I mean, the gulls, I think I feel the same way Glode does about gulls. I'm not particularly fond of them. And they seem to insinuate themselves into the story quite naturally. But I love birds. And so how do I keep them out? I don't. I haven't, apparently. You know, they're the ultimate survivor, and they're a wonderful creature in that they ostensibly are so fragile and, you know, that seemingly could be pulled apart by the faintest wind, yet they live in this harsh, bitter environment, and they're perfectly suited for it. I mean, a little chickadee, a beautiful little bird, you know, it's out there in the howling gale at 40 below zero, and somehow they thrive in it.
Well, I liked it when they showed up, not the gulls, but the other birds. Many parts of The Plowman read like poetry. He sits high on the spring seat, and the tractor churns through the dirt, and the polished discs are small, brilliant suns themselves, turning the soil in long, slow serpents. The river in the distance is a shimmering knife blade. This is not the sort of prose that would allow a writer to just whip out a novel every few months. This had to take a long time. So what kept you coming back to this dark story over and over again for as long as it would take to get it all written down?
Well, it did take quite a while, as you imply. I work sort of glacially anyway. And by necessity, because of work and the vicissitudes of life and so on, I had to work on this book as well as the others in essentially 3-month increments. My wife and I would save during the year, back when I was wearing the tool belt, save during the year to buy 3 months in the wintertime to work on this book or whatever project was going on at the time. So needless to say, after 8 or 9 months away from it, you're pretty hungry to get back to it. So I had that as an incentive, in addition to which I knew I had just a short amount of time to work, and I had to work very intensely. But particularly with this story, it had percolated in my head for many years before I even began to work on it. And, you know, these characters are so compelling to me, they began to take over the various sections of my brain until I could hardly not work on it. You know, Bill Kittredge said once that he knew things were going well with this book when he began to dream about his own characters. And it was kind of like that with this book. I mean, they began to do things in my head just as though you were dreaming about your own children or your parents or your pet or something like that.
Well, we've been talking about this guy, John Glode, and I'd like you to read part of chapter 1 just so that we can get a little better sense of who he is and your writing style.
As if to fend off a blow, he threw up his arms in front of his face, and the first bullet went through his thin forearm and through the top half of his right ear and went whirring into the evening like a maddened wasp. The next, as he turned to run, took him high in the back of the neck, and he fell headlong and did not move. The old man went to him and examined the wound critically. He turned the boy over. The bullet had come out below his nose, and the old man considered its work, while the boy batted his eyes and took in the sky beyond the killer's bland and placid face, gray clouds of failing winter, a small black leaf, a black kite, at last an enormous wheel of March's starlings descending with the mere sound of breath. From where he sat, the old man could see the river, the white caps and the pitching gulls indistinguishable, and he could see the tallest buildings of the old smelter works beyond the coulee's steep flanks, and in the east the shadowed Missouri breaks, raggedly diminishing into the hazy blue gloaming of coming spring. He could feel the last of winter in the wind, see it in the color of the river, gray and churning like molten lead. The soil there was poor and sandy, and the grass on those slopes grew sporadically and reminded him of pig's hair. There were yucca and prickly pear, and he could hear like a faint voice in his ear the hiss of blowing soil at the ridge crest. Still a farmer, he thought. He sifted the dirt through his fingers. The slope below was nearly bare and troughed by the melt-off of 10,000 springtimes. Still a goddamn farmer. Seed put down here would most likely just wash away. Scattered about lay cobbles of sandstone, spalls of shale like medieval roof tiles randomly shingling the slanted ground. A gull came near enough that above the wind and the sea spray hiss, he could hear its thin woman cry. He looked up briefly, then called to the young man below him in the coulee bottom. "Deeper," he said. "You gotta make it deeper." The man looked up and leaned on his shovel handle briefly and then continued to dig. "Hear me?" he said. "I hear you." The younger man was sweating and had thrown aside his jacket, its arms twisted among the brittle weeds. He watched the digger assail the dirt ineffectually, then raised his eyes to the broken landscape below him. He liked this place. He had used it before, and that comforted him. It was like a warehouse he knew well, and that was there when he needed it, quiet and close to town. The dirt was poor, but there were few rocks and the digging was easy. Boys came to this side of the river in the early fall to sight in their rifles for hunting season. The sound of gunfire was not unusual. At the head end of nearly every coulee lay boxes with targets taped to them, and brass shell casings lay about everywhere as though a series of battles had raged down the ravines and over the low divides and sere hills. Shortly the other man laid aside his shovel and waited, and then the two of them rolled the body in, and they began covering it over, one with the shovel, the other, the farmer, because he still held the blunt pistol, pushing in the soil with the side of his foot. The wind swept momentarily down into the raw gulch, and the hair on the older man's balding pate stood straight up. The gull circled, calling into the pale blue sky, where immense banks of cloud raced toward low mountains in the south, bound to the stratosphere by filaments of distant rain. The older man, whose name was John Glode, stooped to pick up a grain sack, which held in its bottom the severed hands and head of the young man whose body they'd just consigned to the thin and unproductive soil of the Missouri River breaks. Anonymous bones now, among others, John Glode's dark signature on the landscape of the world. 200 years earlier, the wayfarers under Lewis and Clark had portaged over this very ground, trundling their boats in the heat around the impassable falls. Glode, never voluble when he was at work, remembered that bears had once lived here, and the thought made him smile. "Bears," he said, "grizzly bears, right here." The young man looked at him uncomprehendingly. Don't give me that look, Glowed said. I'm trying to teach you something. Used to run around here like gophers. 150 years ago, they would have had this asshole dug up and ate before we got over the hill. The older man pointed up the slope where dun cheatgrass sawed about under the March wind. Imagine their old silver tips, a totter on their hind legs like lethal storybook ogres, sorting out the scent of them. Course they might have got us, too. He held the small pistol flat in his palm and considered it. This goddamn thing wouldn't do nothing but put a little spring in their step while they ripped your head off. Glowed surveyed the country around, imagining the hills alive with such beasts. He ran his eyes up and down his thin partner appraisingly. You wouldn't make nothing more than a bitty turd pile. They walked then down along the flat coulee bottom, the younger man with the shovel over his shoulder like an infantryman. They stepped among bluestem and sagebrush, bottle shards glistering in the silt like gemstones, and passed without note the stripped bone cages of the poached and butchered deer of the previous fall.
There were times when I had to get out my dictionary because you are a person who knows how to choose the right word, and they aren't words that we use every day.
Well, you know, I hear that quite frequently, and sometimes it's a criticism. You know, my feeling is we have this English language, which is this enormous palette with all these virtually innumerable colors, and you know, I find it difficult to limit myself when there's all these different hues one can choose among these different words. There's a fine line, I think, that you don't want to cross where you become pedantic and talk down to people like George Will or something. But I just feel that I don't want to be limited by not using a lot of these wonderful words. I had a interesting conversation and correspondence with a famous writer who objected to using some of these words. And my point was, if one is used the word bright or brilliant a number of times up to a certain point, why wouldn't one use the word refulgent? Because it means the same thing. And to me, it has a great sound off the tongue, a very musical sound. I just don't want to be limited. That's my point.
I have to look at this paper. Yep. This is the only word in the entire book that I wrote down. I didn't know what it meant. And you see right there, it says refulgent.
Oh. Oh,
I hadn't looked it up yet, but now you've told me and I'll never forget it.
Oh, well, good. I've accomplished that at least.
Kim Zupan lives in Missoula, Montana. You'll find more information about him and the Plowmen at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, links to our podcast and Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.